If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to the May 4th, 2020 Shelter in Place edition of IMRU Radio Magazine. Hello, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Mother's Day is Sunday, May 10th this year, and nobody had a more contentious relationship with their mommy dearest than Christina Crawford. Steve Pride gets the 411. In Storytellers, I talked to ex-pro basketball player DeMarco Majors. And to celebrate the launch of the Circus of Books documentary on Netflix, Vosh and Wenzel talk to filmmaker Rachel Mason. But first, some honest tea. From AmericanIndependent.com, April 30th, 2020, reported by Casey Quinlan. Far-right groups are taking their anti-LGBTQ agenda to lockdown protests. A slew of far-right groups who've openly embraced anti-LGBTQ messages are taking part in so-called lockdown protests across the country, further endangering the lives of LGBTQ people who are already vulnerable to the coronavirus. Groups like the Proud Boys and right-wing militia groups are among those protesting the many statewide stay-at-home orders. The Michigan chapter of the Proud Boys, a so-called Western chauvinist group that has pushed transphobic, racist, and sexist rhetoric and encourages members to commit acts of violence, recently attended a lockdown protest in Lansing, Michigan. In December last year, Michigan Liberty Militia's Facebook page posted a heterosexual Pride Month meme that depicted a family holding an umbrella over their heads to prevent LGBTQ pride colors from touching them. Because, you know, once you get the gay on you, that never comes out, no matter how many times you put it in the wash. Journalists and anti-fascist activists have also spotted other right-wing groups at these protests, including organizers of last year's Boston Straight Pride Parade and a member of the National Socialist Movement in Ohio. The National Socialist Movement, an anti-Semitic and racist group, attended Detroit's Motor City Pride Festival last year, where they made Nazi salutes and tore apart pride flags. The Boston Straight Pride organizers' Facebook posts have also included anti-LGBTQ memes and references to Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, who killed political dissidents by throwing them from helicopters. Activists also claim to have seen supporters of QAnon at some of the rallies, a baseless conspiracy that claims high-profile Democrats are involved in a global pedophilia ring. Though a few QAnon supporters are members of the LGBTQ community themselves, a substantial portion of its followers endorse homophobic views, the Advocate notes, specifically the idea that marriage equality is a ploy to push for open pedophilia, a common anti-gay trope. According to a 2019 Southern Poverty Law report, transphobic rhetoric among hate groups appears to be on the rise more broadly, with white nationalists targeting events such as drag queen story hours at libraries and bookstores. Those events feature drag queens reading books to children about family diversity and gender issues. Do not mess with my drag queen story hour. From GSN, GayStarNews.com, April 28th, 2020, Grindr witch hunt sparks fresh call to make gay sex legal in Morocco. As GSN reported last week, a Moroccan expatriate living in Turkey called Niaful Moussa, or Sophia Toulouni, sparked the crisis. She is a social media influencer and went on Instagram Live to tell Moroccan women about Grindr, Planet Romeo, and other apps used by gay men. She told women to use fake photos of men to catfish men using the gay dating and hookup apps. And speaking in Moroccan Arabic, Moussa said, translated, "These apps will show you the people who are near to you, 100 meters, 200 meters, or even just 1 meter, just next to you in the living room. Since everyone is together at home, it could show you your husband in your bedroom. It could show you your son, who might be in the bathroom. Musa didn't explicitly tell people to use what they found out to publicly out men, but LGBT plus people in Morocco say the catfishers have put their photos and details online. The result has been a campaign of online harassment, and many LGBT plus Moroccans are now living in fear that their family will discover their sexuality. Meanwhile, they risk being kicked out of their homes by relatives or landlords, losing their jobs, and being ostracized by their neighbors. Human Rights Watch has demanded Morocco change the law to decriminalize same-sex relationships. Likewise, LGBT plus organizations in North Africa have also made the same demand. They are led by Association Akaliyat, which publicized a public statement on Facebook signed by other LGBT plus and human rights organizations in the country. Both male and female same-sex sexual activity is illegal in Morocco. Under Article 489 of the Penal Code, offenders face anything from 6 months to 3 years imprisonment and a fine. Graham Reed is LGBT rights director at Human Rights Watch, and he said, "The consequences of outing can be detrimental to LGBT people's livelihoods, safety, and mental health." From Reuters.com, April 29th, 2020, reported by Oscar Lopez and the Thomson Reuters Foundation, wave of trans murders sparks fear of hunting season in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico has been hit by an epidemic of violence, with 5 transgender murders in 2 months, LGBT plus activists said, adding that homophobic rhetoric from politicians and religious leaders may have fueled the bloodshed. Opposition lawmakers and campaigners called on the government to publicly acknowledge and investigate the violence after the bodies of 2 trans women were found inside a charred car last week and another trans woman was killed in February. "Trans people are living in fear. They are terrified," said Pedro Julio Serrano, spokesman for the Broad Committee for the Search for Equality, an LGBT plus rights advocacy group. "It's as if they've opened hunting season against the LGBT plus community, and they're hunting us. They're looking for us, and they are killing us." The Puerto Rican governor's office did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Police Commissioner Henry Escalera Rivera said that he had met with representatives of the LGBT plus community to work together for a better Puerto Rico. "We have general orders and procedures that guide officers on how to intervene with members of the LGBT plus community," he said. "As always, we have our doors open to dialogue and discuss any proposal for the benefit of Puerto Rico." But the predominantly Roman Catholic island has a history of violence and intolerance towards gay and trans people, with 10 LGBT plus people killed in less than 18 months in the latest crime wave. Governor Ricardo Rossello resigned in 2019 after hundreds of pages of group chat messages were leaked, including homophobic comments about gay pop star Ricky Martin, who is Puerto Rican. If you have a government that does not investigate, that does not care that LGBT plus people are being murdered, you are certainly sending a message as a society that these people are worth nothing. February's killing of trans woman Alexa Negron Luciano made global headlines after a video circulated online, apparently showing her being shot while men laughed. Ramon Luis Nueves, a former senator who is running for office again this year, said Puerto Ricans' attitudes towards gay and trans people needed to change. "While discrimination may have been eradicated from the law books, we still have a ways to go to eradicate discrimination and hatred from the minds and hearts of many." From BuzzFeed.com, April 28, 2020, reported by Hannah Ryan in Australia. A court guessed how gay men from conservative families would react after first having sex. It cost 2 men their refugee status. 2 young men from Pakistan who feared persecution because they were in a homosexual relationship had their refugee claims rejected because a tribunal made illogical assumptions about how they would respond to their first time having sex, a court has found. The decision of the Federal Court of Australia to send the case back to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, AAT, to be heard again marks the latest chapter in the pair's 7-year battle to have their sexuality claims believed and to be recognized as refugees. At the tribunal hearing in April 2016, some 6 years after they said they started having sex, each man told a slightly different story about what happened next. One said they did not immediately discuss what had happened and went about their normal routine the next day, and that they next had sex a couple of weeks later. The other man said they did talk that night and the next day, and he thought they had sex again within the next few days. When the tribunal asked about the discrepancy, the two men said it had been a long time and that they only remembered 60 to 70% of what happened. The tribunal found both men were not credible witnesses and that they were not gay, in part because that explanation was implausible. Both claimed to have come from conservative families who would strongly disapprove of what they had done, and for both of them it was their first time having sex and their first significant gay sexual experience, as well as the first time they revealed to each other that they were gay. All of those factors meant that they would have been able to remember what happened afterwards and when they next had sex, the tribunal concluded. Now, the federal court has overturned those findings, saying the tribunal's reasoning about what the men would have done after their first sexual experience was logically flawed and irrational. The tribunal made assumptions about the expected psychological response that the men would immediately discuss what had happened and that they would remember clearly when they next had sex. But these assumptions were not proved by evidence. That pesky evidence. It cannot be said that the psychological reactions of a couple to their first sexual encounter are matters of common human experience, Justices Bernard Murphy and Michael O'Brien wrote. The judges ordered the case to be sent back to the tribunal for a new hearing. And that's the honest tea. Children sometimes have a complex relationship with parents. But one lady who had real mother issues was Christina Crawford, and she shared them with longtime pal Steve Pride.
Joan Crawford was one of the biggest stars of Hollywood films in the 1930s and 40s. She often played tough, independent women, and her screen presence and characterizations attracted a movie-going audience that included a significant number of lesbians and gay men. Recently, I met with her daughter, Christina Crawford, to talk about her childhood and the release of the 25th anniversary edition of her book, Mommy Dearest.
The major part that was left out of the 78 edition were the years of my adult relationship with my adopted mother. When we were both in New York, I was an actress. She, of course, had been an actress. My career was on the ascendancy. Her career was non-existent.
However, it's not her adult relationship with Joan Crawford, but her childhood memories that have haunted our collective nightmares since the original version of Mommy Dearest was first published in 1978. And although until now the book has been out of print for 10 years, the film version with Faye Dunaway was always around as a reminder of her traumatic youth.
Well, my brother and I called them night raids because it was like a terrorist attack. And we never knew what caused it. We didn't know how to anticipate it. Well, there wasn't anything we could do anyway because we were basically captive. So we became this little survival team like SEALs, you know? But we could do nothing against what happened when she went into her rages.
No wire hangers! What's wire hangers doing in this closet when I told you no wire hangers ever? Work and work till I'm half dead, and I hear people saying she's getting old. What do I get? A daughter! Who cares as much about the beautiful dresses I give her as she cares about me? What's wire hangers doing in this closet? Answer me!
The wire hanger night was only one of many. Very often she would come and rip the covers off of us, haul us out of bed, me, because he was tied in. She'd haul me out of bed and make me do some Herculean feat of cleaning in the middle of the night, in the pitch black. And then she'd make a terrible mess and leave me, and I'd just be crying and sweating and crying and pleading with God to let me live to grow up. But one time, it didn't have anything to do with my brother or me. She got everybody in the house up in the middle of the night, and it happened to be quite a full moon, I remember, so we could see even though there were no lights on. And we had a beautiful, beautiful rose garden that the man that worked as a gardener for us really, it was a labor of love, gorgeous, beautiful roses. And she was in a terrible rage, and maybe a castration rage now that I think about it as an adult. And she cut down all these beautiful rose bushes. I mean, they were huge.
Tina! Bring me the axe!
And she made us cart them off with no gloves, no sleeves, so we were all bloody and bleeding. It was disgusting. And she got the servants up to do this too, so we knew it didn't have anything to do with us. And then, to our absolute horror, she cut down an orange tree. And it was like, after she did that, it like took the steam out of her, and she went to sleep. As a child, it was a very terrifying experience, because tonight the roses, tomorrow night maybe me.
Joan Crawford's most famous role was Mildred Pierce, the story of a mother so full of love that she sacrifices everything for her selfish, ungrateful daughter.
You've been snooping around ever since I got this job, trying to find out what it is. And now you know. You know, don't you?
Know what? Know what, Mother?
You knew when you gave that uniform to Lottie that it was mine, didn't you?
Your uniform?
Yes, I'm waiting tables in a downtown restaurant.
My mother. A Beatrice.
I took the only job I could get so you and your sister could eat and have a place to sleep and some clothes on your back.
The irony is not lost on Christina Crawford.
You know, the very interesting thing is, after she played Mildred Pierce in the movie, she adopted the language of Mildred Pierce, but not the behavior of Mildred Pierce, with me for years and years and years. She would always say how ungrateful I was. Well, there was nothing to be grateful for.
Mommy Dearest sold millions of copies in its original printing, and the film has become a cult classic. But Christina believes that the longer story she tells in this new edition has an important message of its own. Until next time, this is Steve Pride.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Maupin's Tales of the City, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Beginning under the nondescript title, The Serial, Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City series has developed into a phenomenon transcending boundaries of time and sexuality. In 1974, Maupin began his series of short tales in the weekly newspaper Pacific Sun, and it was soon picked up by the San Francisco Chronicle. Already a hit in San Francisco and with the nationwide gay audience, the series became mainstream with the first book-length collection of tales in 1978. Many books have followed. Centered on the occupants of 28 Barbary Lane, Maupin's tales address issues of race and class with humor and a keen knowledge of current events. They were one of the first literary works to include the subject of AIDS and its implications both inside and outside the gay world. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Steve Bush.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. DeMarco Majors is an ex-pro basketball player, an actor, model, and TV host. Majors played for teams in Australia, Brazil, Argentina, and the American Basketball Association. He joins us via phone. Welcome to IMRU, DeMarco Majors.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your platform as a spokesperson for gay athletes around the world, it gives you a unique opportunity. What are some of the most glaring misconceptions about gay athletes that you've been able to dispel, debunk, set straight, so to speak?
One of the myths and one of the things that I feel that I was a part of debunking is that gay men can't play sports. It's fascinating to me, and it also amazes me that people actually believe that your sexuality pulls you back from being able to perform as an athlete, when in fact, it is sports that separate you from your sexuality to give you a safe space to navigate in. When you're a young man or woman learning how to play sports, you get to be outside of that fear, outside of that shame. Another one is, this is a funny one, locker rooms are not a gay man's fantasy in sports. It's really interesting that when I was younger, my biggest fear when I got to pro sports was that because I was accepting of myself and I had to prove myself on the court invisibly. So when we got into the locker room, most people had no clue. So they would talk to me. We're around each other, getting dressed. You're naked. You're in the showers. You would be most people's fantasy is a huge fear because you don't want people to look at you in a way of fear. You want to be accepted for just who you are. You want to be accepted for your athleticism, your athletic IQ. So you take the whole idea of sexualizing and over-sexualizing when you're in the locker room, you know, in certain situations and even in the shower, those are the most intimate places. And so I was very clear in my mind and in my heart, I never looked at another player sexually like that because I did not want to be treated that way. Now, I'm not saying that I never had certain situations happen. Those situations were other people's fear when they find out you're gay. And they have myths that every gay man wants to look at them or touch them. And I had to say to a teammate one time, I asked him, I said, in front of everybody, I'm not being arrogant, but I want you to look at yourself. And then I want you to look at me. Why would I be attracted to you when you're not even attracted to yourself? And then, you know, you get the whole ooze and all that other stuff. But the player also knew that on the basketball team, I'm not a tough guy. That's not how I grew up. But what you won't do is disrespect me. We're not going to live that type of life. We're going to be very respectful of each other. We're going to communicate on the court that this is about team. It's about family. It's about working hard. It's not about my sexuality nor yours. But I was young back in those days.
When you came out as an athlete, not unlike when it comes to racial issues in this country and having to prove yourself even harder if you're not a straight white male, what was it like for you as an athlete when you came out? How much more conscious and self-conscious were you of this? And how did that sort of either impede or inspire you?
When I guess you can say come out because I didn't know that there was a coming out thing. I didn't know that that was a thing because I had never been in the gay community, straight community. I was an athlete. I was a very religious person. So I had never been around people who were, this was that experience. You had to talk to people and come out. I just answered a question. People would ask me, are you gay? And I'd be like, yes, because I didn't know that it was a thing. When I started playing pro ball, I was still a virgin. So I had never been with a man or a woman before in my entire life. I was a virgin until I was 24, almost 25 years old. But at this time, when I first started, I was like 22. I started going on mission trips and playing ball and all this stuff. I was always aware of my surroundings because it just wasn't safe being black.
Yeah, there are things that you have to think about that me, as a white man, is not part of my daily consciousness.
Absolutely. I was taught at a very young age by family members. At home, you are Marco. The moment you step outside that door, you are a little black boy. You are a black man. And that is, for a lot of people in this world and in this country and in your hometown in Indiana, your skin color, son, is a weapon to people. It causes fear. And I didn't understand that, but I had to know that. I had to know how to talk to people. I had to make sure it wasn't that, oh, you need to speak jive, you need to do this. No, I had to speak in a certain way in order for people to not only take me seriously, but it's an education of self because you have to understand your surroundings.
When did your father have this conversation with you? And it was just your father, or was it a father and mother conversation?
Well, it was my mom. It was my mom who I had to have these conversations with. My father had his own set of issues because my father was a paraplegic my entire life. I'd never seen my father walk. My mom is the one that I had to learn in the fourth grade. My fourth grade teacher was giving me D's and F's. My mom was very, very strict on me in my formative years as a young boy. I had to come home and do my homework. No questions asked. You better not turn on that TV and make sure those chores are done.
This is Michael Taylor Gray, and you're listening to my interview with actor, model, TV host, and former professional basketball player, DeMarco Majors.
And she's seen my work, so she knew that it wasn't D's and F's. And then she got so upset Because at first, you know, I was getting punished, I was getting whoopings and all this other stuff. Like, why are you getting bad grades? And then she went up to the school, and when she walked into the room, that teacher, it made sense. That was this teacher that she had when she was in grade school, and he was a very racist person. And he learned very fast whose child I was, because he looked there and he said, Portia, the ball's in your court. She jumped up and slapped him in his face. And you don't want to be that kid in school. Like, everybody's like, whose mama is that? But those are the lessons that you learn in Indiana very fast, especially when you're going to school in the 80s. As far as coming into professional sports, my first opportunities of going overseas was with a small Christian group. I noticed the racism in the Christian group. And a lot of them would say, oh, God, here we go again. Yes, it is here we go again, because I'm seeing you guys recite scripture, book, chapter, and verse, yet the way you treat me is anything, you don't even realize it. And because I was very, very quiet, I internalized it until I was asked one day by the leader coming back from a game when I was in Argentina playing. And the leader said to me, he said, DeMarco, what do you think? You never talk. And I said, are you sure you want to hear what I have to say? Of course, yes. I said, honestly, you guys are a bunch of hypocrites. You don't even realize it. Each one of you speaks a good game about being a Christian in the Bible, but you recite books from other men rather than looking at each other and confessing sin and going to scriptures and actually helping one another. You are supposed to confess to each other and read those scriptures and pray together, and none of you do that at all. And when I talk to you about racial things, because you don't experience what I experience on the basketball court, you don't experience these European men in Argentina hitting you harder and saying things to you in Portuguese and in Spanish that are very racial things. You don't get to experience that. That's what I'm experiencing. And when I start to share these things with you, you guys turn your heads. You're very hypocritical. Everyone looked at me and they were just like, every single time we have a discussion, you have to talk.
You found your voice and you waited for the moment to express it. You spoke with such clarity and without judgment, but with observation. You were observing people's actual behavior and the consequences of that behavior and how it affected you. And when asked, you told it like it is.
That was my heart, because I was in such an in-between place. Here I am with this Christian group doing missionary work and playing professional basketball. I've got an understanding that when you have clarity, you give other people peace, because you are no longer a piece of yourself. You are a whole person. So when you have clarity, you also get peace. And that was an important lesson that I was fortunate enough to understand at that age. And I'm very grateful for that opportunity.
On an even deeper and more personal level, you opened up about a chapter in your life for BuzzFeed News, reported by Patrick Strudwick, in a way that I have rarely seen. It literally took my breath away, DeMarco. I firmly believe that your story and the three others that were featured in that article can and will save lives. Now, for our listeners, the article for BuzzFeed News is entitled, "This is Why Queer People of Color Are Becoming Addicted to Meth and Sex." Now, why was participating in this news feature so important to you?
What an amazing question, because you have no idea. The shirt that I have on right now, because I just thought today was just important. I didn't have any idea of this question at all, but I thought today was going to be so special, and it was important to me. Last year, my friend and one of my first mentors in the gay community, black man, Timothy Dean, was found dead in Ed Buck's home. And his best friend, Alex, he went through the house and he found something, and he presented a shirt to me and said, I believe Tim would have wanted you to have something. He would have wanted you to have this. And I'm wearing that shirt right now, so this question means so much to me. Being able to share my story was very important to me, because I no longer wanted to live in the story, no longer wanted to live in the idea, in the trauma, in the manipulation of what the world sees as someone who has been an addict, someone who has an addiction. It was very important for me to heal, and being able to now have the words that could actually flow without me forcing the words. Because sometimes we get in such a space where we force words to come out because we need to answer something. It just wasn't time for me before, because it just wasn't my time. Being a part of Patrick's article was really important to me, because I needed healing. And if I could ever share with anyone, at any moment of time, especially when it, in regards to addiction, because before you get to the chemicals, you actually have an addiction to the emotions and the trauma and the very things that were going on with you that took you down that path. That's why it was so important to me. If I could share anything that was a part of my life with someone, anyone, even if it's just one person, that could see value in that and gain a perspective of their own self-worth and step into their own light and their own space and their own healing, then my life and my experiences in my life was worth it, because I didn't just go through all of that with just cause. I know for a fact that on my path in this journey, there are people along that path that I am supposed to meet, that are supposed to get the blessing. And if I continue to live in trauma, if I continue to live in fear, if I continue to live in this stigma, then those people who are on my path would not get the blessing and the understanding that they need, because what was given to me at birth. So I had to remove myself from discouragement, because I truly believe that discouragement is distancing yourself from courage. And I wanted to have courage in my life. And so I decided, what was I distancing myself from courage with? And it was my anxiety, my fear, my addiction, my sexuality. So I really had to break those things down and overcome those things. And the closer I get to courage, the better off not only my life will be, but those people who will be on my path will be. Hopefully I was able to take the path of humility and share in such a way that people, that it could resonate with them and they could find peace in their own life.
You take the shame out of it. And because you share it so honestly and so openly, that's the gift you're giving to people who feel the weight of the shame of the stumbles that have happened in their life.
Thank you for saying that. And I really, really appreciate it. When you've walked streets in the dead of winter, in the cold of the East Coast, and you feel like people are looking at you weird and you feel hurt, you don't want to do something that could harm you, but the addiction is so strong in you that you feel like you're on autopilot. Other times when you walk in the height of summer and you're feeling amazing about yourself, and then you have this thing that whispers, this monkey on your back whispers to you and pulls you in a direction that you may or may not want to go into. When you're able to remove yourself from moments like that, you have no other choice but to be humble about your approach and your story. Because guess what? Shame is not the place and not the space that will heal you. It's not going to save you. It's not going to protect you. And no one on this earth is going to save you from yourself. That is something that you have to do.
DeMarco Majors, when all is said and done, what do you want your legacy to be?
I would say it's not important about being the first, but to be effective at what you do. And if anything would be put on my headstone or people that remember DeMarco Majors, I am perfect as I am and as I am not.
Can you tell our listeners where we can find you on social media?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram and Facebook at my name, DeMarco Majors, D Majors, D-E, capital M-A-J-O-R-S on Instagram.
Thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Storytellers. What's your story? In a 2017 interview published in PLUS magazine, Majors revealed publicly that he was living with HIV, which he contracted after being sexually assaulted. A recovering addict, Majors has since used his life to raise awareness for larger causes.
The tale of Armistead Maupin, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Incredibly, gay literary icon Armistead Maupin was raised in a conservative Christian family. He even worked briefly with the arch-segregationist and right-wing standard-bearer, Jesse Helms. After serving in the Navy, including a tour in Vietnam, Maupin turned to journalism. He worked for papers in Charleston and then the Associated Press in San Francisco. There, he began his celebrated Tales of the City series, first in Bay Area papers and later in book form. A pillar of gay literature, Maupin never wanted to be pigeonholed. "I'm very proud of being in the gay and lesbian section," he once said, "but I don't want to be told that I can't sit up in the front of the bookstore with the straight, white writers." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Steve Bush.
Hello, I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The truth is rarely pure and never simple." That's why it's imperative that we stay informed, so pull up your ears. An excellent way to do this is by listening to Southern California's longest-running radio program for the gay and lesbian community, IMRU.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Last year, Wenzel Jones and Vash Bodhi sat down with documentarian Rachel Mason to talk about her film, Circus of Books.
I'm the director of the Circus of Books. I'm also the child of the owners of the store, which is what led me to make the film. I'm an artist, musician, and filmmaker.
And for those who are not familiar with the phenomenon that was Circus of Books, could you explain to the audience just what those bookstores were?
The two Circus of Books stores were basically landmarks in the LGBTQ community back when being queer was illegal in the city of Los Angeles and before there was a city of West Hollywood, which was basically incorporated to protect the gay community that was under a threat of police violence, of just violence, period. And the store served as an anchor in both the most important gay communities in Los Angeles, and it was a safe place for people to come, but it was also a place where you could find literature and materials and then eventually DVDs and VHS and watch things that you would not get to see anywhere else.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you're making it sound almost like Sisterhood Bookstore in Westwood, which was a very straight-laced, serious, that catered to the lesbian community. This was more fun.
Yeah, we could take the gloves off now, but it was the place for cruising, and the one in West Hollywood, at least, was anchored right across from the Gold Coast Bar, and there were all of these alley, famously called Vaseline Alley, in the back, and it was just a really, really, really significant place for tons of gay sex, basically. Mm-hmm.
And then Silver Lake was right there at
Sunset Junction, yeah. And Silver Lake had a really different kind of vibe, but I think also similarly there was a Silver Lake Vaseline Alley of sorts. And, you know, it was also two very different communities that I think represent the different parts of LA. Silver Lake was definitely more diverse and West Hollywood was more white. And I think that was just something that absolutely reflected the communities where the stores were.
Mm-hmm. For our listening audience, in your own words, what would you say that Circus of Books, your film, is really about?
It's actually a film about family and family values and religion. As crazy as that sounds, the sort of like the veneer of gay porn on top of a film that at its heart is about a family that was struggling to come to terms with being part of the heteronormative culture that we live in, which is my parents really just being parents, and at the same time having this store that was so centrally located in a pretty hostile environment for so many years within our culture for gay people. And then also things within my own family that led to my mother in particular having to grapple with her own religious views, which were really hard line and were in a lot of ways, amazingly, not in line with the progressive values of the store. So we come to see a transition with my mom in her awakening, basically, of understanding what it really means to be truly a part of the acceptance of gay, lesbian, trans, the larger LGBTQAI family.
When you say my parents ran the gay porn / literature store, in a lot of people's mind, they're probably thinking, oh, I bet mom wore lots of eyeliner and caftans and jangling, and dad was probably old. No, they were the definition of mom and pop.
Yes, that is what's really funny. I mean, I've had people say, were your parents like two leather daddies? I have a lot of friends that have gay parents that were cool parents that were, you know, not what my parents were. They were just, you know, my dad is a quintessential nerdy guy. And my mom is the ultimate Jewish mother packed into somebody that's also very business savvy, soccer mom, type A. So they were the opposite of cool parents to me, or even parents involved in the gay community. So that is what makes it funny.
One of the most quintessential mom moments to me in the whole movie is your mother's running around and she's got all these titles. And I forget, is she reading them or something? But she turns to the camera and says, I never watched these. You know, it was very important that you know she doesn't know what's in them. But she's been selling them for years. And that's such a mom thing to do to me.
Wow, it's interesting to hear you say it's such a mom thing, because I associate with my mom. It seems like so my mom, because I had friends that really did have cool parents who would have been like, let's go to the drag club. You know, I had friends with really cool parents in LA. They were actors, they were dancers, they were doing interesting things. And so for me, it's so annoying and frustrating that my mom would always be like, well, I would never touch this stuff. I have never seen it. You know, it's like, oh, it's just so Victorian, you know, and it's like, mom, you're hustling hardcore gay porn and you've been making it for years. Like, what is the problem? Just accept it. It's cool. It's fine. Everyone's into it. And people who aren't, like, seriously, who needs them?
It's so funny that you're talking about the line that this film walks. It's so yin and yang. Like, on one side, your mom is all about Hebrew school, getting everyone through their bar and bat mitzvahs. Yeah. And then on the other side, being a spearhead for First Amendment rights, for access to pornography, for people being able to be who they are in a way that no one else I know has ever done. It's so amazing to see that line walked and you being on one side of it, seeing your parents, and then the rest of the world getting a chance to see them in the other way.
Wow, it's interesting, yes, to hear that you say it in that way, the line walk. One of the moments for me that really, I think, nailed that line, but kind of blurred it too, was when my mom goes to the One Archives, because I know deep in her heart, she gets it. I really do know. There's just, she's been repressed. She's been overladen with the biblical voice of this is what morality is. And I can see that that's what she was raised in, this really strict way. And then she was trying to pass on that strict way. But when you go to the One Archives and you see this professor, you know, Joseph Hawkins, he's the director and he's this perfect, you know, academic guy. And then it just seemed like my mom was able to let it all go for a second because she was looking at this wall, which wasn't like, quote unquote, obscene pornography. It was just the original pamphlets that were in the One Archives, which are one of the very first publications that were mailed out. And it still gives me chills when I watch that scene, because she makes the point that, can you imagine being a guy in the 1940s or 50s living in Iowa, getting a copy of one of these? I understood at that moment that she got what she did, because she was doing that here in LA, but in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, when it was still like, oh my God, could you imagine walking into that store? And I had many different men tell me, it is predominantly men who appreciated that store. And people were telling me, if I hadn't ever gone into the store, I wouldn't have known in 1973 that I wasn't just some guy with some like perverse fantasy in my head, because there was nothing in the world representing it except a terrible stigma, which was to be labeled a sissy or something awful, or just the idea of being in love with a gay man or seeing erotic sexual imagery. It was so shocking. And people were telling me, like, just tell your parents thank you. They don't even realize what they did. And so that was the kind of revelation for me as someone who grew up in the 90s and all my friends were queer, and I didn't actually appreciate that at all. I never understood that there was a time when that was like that. So,
well, now, what was your personal awakening like? Because when you were a little kid, you knew mom and dad ran a bookstore. Did you gradually find out what kind of a bookstore is, or did you wander in by accident one day? How did you figure out what mom and dad were really doing?
I think when I was really young in elementary school, we had to keep the name of the store a secret from our teachers, which I didn't think anything of. Parents tell you to do certain things, you just do them. But I did remember one of my teachers was just like, well, what's the name of this store? Why can't you tell me the name? You know? And I was like, well, I'm not supposed to say the name of the store. And the teacher thought that was really weird, and she finally dragged it out of me. And then she just gave me the funniest look when I said, well, it's called Circus of Books. And she just was like, huh. And it was like, okay, well, you know, I would have thought you would say, like, great. Instead, it was just like, huh. And I didn't think anything of it. But then when, of course, I'm an artist and I went to high school and I found my people who were all the queer, awesome, gay, you know, we weren't even thinking of ourselves as gay. We were just like outsiders who like thumbed our nose at, you know, society and loved anything campy, found John Waters movies on VHS and drag culture, queer culture, all of it. I was immersed in that world. And my friends were like obsessed with Circus of Books. And I thought that was really strange. And I told them that that was my parents' store. And then they thought that was unbelievable. They were like, how is it that your parents own Circus of Books? That is crazy, Rachel. That's like the craziest gay porn store in LA. And what? You know, so it was really shocking to me that my parents were involved in anything cool or countercultural.
Well, yeah, because it did have, not that your parents were literally in the store at all times, but it did have a very local grassrootsy mom and pop feel, whereas things like Drake's in West Hollywood, those were very slick stores.
Mm.
And Circus of Books was definitely a homegrown item, but now, alas, it's gone.
Oh.
No, I mean Circus of Books.
Yeah.
And do you think perhaps the time for that sort of place has passed as well, or?
You know,
because it was here for decades.
It's true. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I do think there was something now that I think of other stores in general, almost all stores try to do a little bit more upkeep than for some reason they just did not care. And I find that was the charm of the store and people loved that about it. It really does reflect, I think, my parents' personalities in some ways. They just, you know, even my mom drives a car until it is literally falls apart and she has to get a new one. The way that they are is very practical. Like, all right, if we don't need to repaint, why should we repaint? And the customers are still buying the stuff. So that reflects somewhat of their personality, that they were just very kind of like modest store owners and weren't, you know, all about branding and didn't even really conceive of it. So everything that ended up being the brand of the Circus of Books was very inadvertent. The slapdash nature of it was just by accident, but it ended up being its signature.
I don't remember this being mentioned in the documentary. Were they part of AIDS education in any way?
Well, in the 80s, one of the things that I think the film chronicles, the store made available whatever was out there in the landscape of gay literature. So if there was something that was out there and anyone wanted to, you know, have it in the store, my mom, if people would buy it and there was a demand for it, she would sell it. So I have no doubt that if that literature was being presented and produced, it would have been in the store. But what I know from my perspective and from talking to my parents is that I think the outreach that they did was that whenever they had employees that they knew were sick, and this is like at the height of the like hysteria. And I remember as a kid, you know, there was this fear, oh, you shouldn't get near anybody, you shouldn't touch them. And I don't quite know what it was that my parents recognized because they were around them that, okay, well, we're not getting sick. And we didn't get it, so it's not something that's contagious, so we're going to keep hiring these people. We're not going to be weird about it. And they kept all those people employed. And many of them, they paid in cash because they would lose their benefits if they had a job. And I think that was sort of the small, really amazing act of kindness that my mom knew the job meant so much to them. And so many people, it was their last job. It was the final thing that they did. And I remember so many different people dying, and these were just, from my kids' perspective, just wonderful, cool, interesting guys. And it would just be, oh, well, he just died, and this person just died, and that person just died. So I remember this sort of many, many, many people all around the store dying, and that was just my viewpoint. And only years later did I realize that they were there for those people and that many of those people had been also abandoned by their families at that time. So I think that was what they did in their outreach. Part of the amazing thing about Ryan Murphy coming on board with this film at the very end, really, when we were ready to complete it, is that he creates TV series, and that's something that is very much of interest to them, and we'll see if that happens. And as crazy as that sounds, it could be fictionalized.
It's totally perfect. It is totally perfect. When you see the film, and I'm talking to people who are listening, you'll understand completely how it's about the family, it's about the store, it's about the environment and the government. I mean, there's so much.
Yeah. I think one of the things, too, is it's about the nuances within queer culture as well. But I think I learned it from the film because I identify as queer, but within the spectrum that is amorphous and shifting. And I love all of the different letters and the LGBTQAIP. You know, I'm excited about all the different things. And I've always been immersed in a world that's countercultural. But when I was interviewing my brother, I realized he was not like that. He was not a counterculture guy. He was not a freak. He was not someone that wanted to hang out with artists. And he just was a regular, normal guy who wanted to fit into mainstream society. And he just happened to be gay. And this is what just led to my revelation, even after the film, that I presented like this wild aesthetic. And I think that's also what still exists today. You know, I love Drag Race, love every single person on it, but it's not for everybody. And I have to recognize that that is one aspect of gay culture. And there's many people that just want to put their heads down and be a pilot or a secretary or do not want to ever show up wearing eye makeup ever, and that's fine. And so I recognize that with my brother and I discussing amongst ourselves his high school experience, I recognize that my like out there flamboyance and fabulous friends were in a weird way also sort of oppressive to him because he was just this little kid trying to be a good, perfect boy. And his only thing was that he was attracted to other guys.
First of all, the moments with you and your brother, it's really emotional. Those were really great moments. But it's so funny when he just tells you that your friends were just too gay, you know? And at a time when he's sort of coming out, you know, everyone thinks people are accepting because, you know, you never really hear the word faggot unless you are out of the room and then you don't really hear it. Yeah. So did you ever ask him, like, what did he hear people saying about you and your friends that perhaps affected the way that he led his life?
Interesting. I'll ask him that now that you mentioned, but I haven't, you know, what I think it was with him. Oh, and I heard, you know, this was the 90s. The word faggot was alive and well, and I heard it all around me, myself. But because I'm just, as a person, so attracted to people that truly don't care and thumb their nose and are like the punks and are just like, you know what, F you, I don't care. Those are like the people that I go towards, and they could be anyone. I'm very attracted to rebellious types. My brother's not. So for him, my whole thing was like, Josh, why would you not want to join my freak brigade? You know, like, come to the parade. We are going. And it was like, no, that's not me, Rachel. I am not like that. And I had to recognize, even now, I look at these amazing Instagram, fully realized, like a six-year-old. I love this Instagrammer who's six and is a fully realized drag queen. But there's also just, what about the six-year-old who is shy and introverted, who's wants to be normcore and, like, really not at all interested in being flamboyant? If they're, you know, the loudest voices in the queer community tend to be the really, really flamboyant wild ones. So I think, I mean, that is why actually I think people like Ellen DeGeneres and the voices of mainstream Ryan Murphy also just presenting as a normal seeming mainstream person that can cross over and communicate with someone on Oprah or whatever and just be like, look, this is what gay is too. You don't have to be a freak show. And I embrace the freak show aspect of queer culture. So,
what do you want your queer freak flag audience to take away from it? And then what do you want people who are nowhere near that culture to take away from the film? Because I think they'll both see two different films.
Yeah, I mean, in a strange way, I think I was making this film for my queer freak flag audience, and I didn't think at all about the mainstream because that has never been a world that I ever expected to penetrate whatsoever. And so... But having the experience now of recognizing that the story of the film, it's not my story, it's the story of the film. I'm partially in it as a character. It's a very universal story. I mean, the way I feel more and more about gay culture, quote unquote, is that it's human culture. There's not a person on this planet that is not literally related to someone, gay, queer, trans. You don't go far beyond like, okay, immediate family, cousins, uncles. We all are connected to, you know, whether or not you're entirely surrounded by gay people or not, we all are in the world with queer people. This is our world. We're all connected. And so I feel like recognizing the struggle that happened within my family that was a struggle about acceptance, really almost the mother-child role or the religious parent-child role, because it could have been my dad too who was religious, but I just feel like the way that we pass on this sort of weighty Judeo-Christian or Islamic, these sort of like ancient biblical texts that had certain things in them that might have related to the time and even at that time might have been wrong, can we reinterpret things? Can we find a way to just open up to the reality that the people in our world that are wonderful, amazing, beautiful people, we can be embraced and we can also try to reconcile our ancient religious philosophies. And that's, strangely enough, I think all those religious philosophies are what lead to pornography being so a thing. Sex was shamed and hence we had to go this route. And then now we have this thing where it's called pornography, and then the government, which is deeply tied into religious traditions, also adds shame to it. So I hope that this dismantles in a subtle but also very heartfelt way some of those oppressive forces within religion.
One thing that struck me, and you kind of keep dancing around this, about you saying it's about your parents, it's about your parents. When I watched the film, especially the second time, I thought, you know who's really responsible for all of this? You and your brothers. Because the only reason why your parents did this was because they had kids and they had to support you.
Wow. That is so interesting. Yeah. You know, it's kind of that. Well, that's what I mean. It's a really weird film about family and family values. It was like they were really desperate to, you know, when you have kids, it's one thing when you're like trying to find a job. But when you have kids and you're trying, it's like, okay, we will do anything. This is come hell or high water. We're going to figure, okay, gay porn, no problem. Bring it.
Keep it from the kids.
Yeah.
What made you decide to make the film?
A long time ago, 2004, I had taken a gender studies class, and one of my professors basically said, you know, this store is really important. You should just do something to preserve it for the historical record. And I recently found some footage that I'd taken, and my mom was like, get that camera out of my face. I am not going to talk to you. You know, it was, and funny enough, it was so many years later, 2014, when the store in Silver Lake was imminently going to close. And a producer in New York I was talking to, Adam Barron, he said, you know, you just need to start shooting. You don't have a choice. If you're going to document this, you need to go out to L.A. And I was in New York at the time. So I realized it was that. It was just the stores were going to close. And it was I felt that sense of loss for my own nostalgic love of the stores. I also knew my sense that I am the only person that can really do this. Because I know how hard my mom will fight anybody who would try. So.
Well, and speaking of a sense of loss, it broke my little heart, or that stone I call my heart, when the store is closing and your mom is taking stuff to the dumpster.
Aww.
I thought, why not just put it in the alley? I bet somebody would find a home for it.
That's such a good point. No, it broke my heart, too, when she made that point. Like, you know, my mom is so, like, pragmatic and harsh in ways, and that's just her personality. But she was like, well, this is where it all wound up, right where it belongs, in the dumpster. And I'm like, Mom, you know, I care about these people. I mean, I literally look at the guys on the cover and I'm like, who are they? Are they alive? Like, I wonder about them. I think about them. And, you know, but that's kind of what it is about, too, is that I can see that she's just going to throw it out. But there's also a sense of, I don't know, is something in that scene, theatricality a little? Like, look, Rachel, you see that? This is meaningless. Turn your camera off. You know, I think it was a little bit like that. Anyhow.
Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story. And I think everybody should try to see this documentary because it's quite something.
And see it before it turns into a television series.
Exactly.
It's going to be the next thing.
See the source material.
How do people find out more information about the film?
If you want to see the film in person, it's at Outfest this Thursday. I will say tickets are almost sold out of the main audience section. But what you can do is if you miss Outfest this Thursday at 8 p.m., there is a Facebook page. It's Circus of Books Documentary. There's also an Instagram, Circus of Books, if you just look it up. And if you Google Circus of Books Documentary, it comes up. And I'll throw this out there. If anyone wants to get in touch, Circus of Books Movie, all one word, Circus of Books Movie at gmail.com.
How would you describe your parents now having made this film?
You know, now that they are in the world with the thing that is about them, I think they feel a little bit like they're coming out of their own closet. And my mom especially. My dad, you know, as you can see in the film, is about the most happy-go-lucky guy on the planet. If we could all be like my dad, that would solve all of our global problems, I think. He's very happy. So almost nothing can faze him one way or the other. He's taking it all with stride, enjoying it. My mom, on the other hand, is very conflicted because this is her awakening into the world that she was trying desperately to hide from. However, she's also an activist. And that's what's really kind of awesome about it, is that there have been enough people who've come up to her and said, you know what, if I had the chance to see my mother make a turnaround like you did, or if I, you know, can I just say thank you because what you did meant something and I wasn't able to have that with my parent. And I think my mom did this bigger thing by being that parent that was really difficult and not cool and came around. And that actually has helped a lot of other people that have seen the film and come up and said thank you to her. So I think she's wrestling with it. And yet also there's so much praise that she's experiencing that too.
People really need to see this story, so I hope people get out to see it at Outfest, and if not, find a way to see it.
Well, it will be on Netflix, too, in the fall, so stay tuned.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you for coming out, Rachel.
Thank you. I love KPFK. Great station.
Thank you for being here, Rachel.
Circus of Books is currently available to stream on Netflix. Well, that's the end of our show. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, and Rainbow Minute producers, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you are a web designer, social media expert, or just interested in LGBTQI community affairs and would like to volunteer with IMRU, email volunteer@imruradio.org. You can also listen to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Radio Public, Stitcher, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts. Although many may think of him as a daddy, Anderson Cooper is an official daddy now, with the birth last week of his son, Wyatt Morgan Cooper. Congratulations, Daddy. We close with the live performance of out-gay saxophonist Dave Cause at a GLAAD benefit in 2008. Good night, and stay well. Good night and stay well.